Hey y'all, it's Lauren. Fighting for Black lives isn't new. And some say that this uprising isn't new either. It's a familiar fight that Black people have been fighting for centuries.
I'm out here because I'm tired of us being killed by those that are here to serve and protect us. I'm tired of my Black brothers, my Black cousins, my Black people, period, being killed for no reason. I'm tired of us being scared to just walk freely in the neighborhood. I'm tired of us being scared to go to the store. I'm tired of us being scared of being pulled over. I'm tired of us being scared. I'm out here because this is unnecessary. I'm out here because it can be prevented. I'm out here because clearly race is still an issue. Clearly being racist is still an issue. And clearly not everyone was taught correctly. I'm out here because it's necessary. And I'm out here because I feel that it is my duty to fight for my freedom. I'm out here because I need to be.
But now, this fight is happening as COVID-19 cases continue to rise, especially within the African-American community. The pandemic, state violence, and racist attacks all have devastating physical consequences, but there is also a mental toll. So in this episode, we hear from a Black healing practitioner and two Black psychologists about how the pandemic and the uprising are impacting the mental health of African-Americans and how Black people can maintain and promote their mental wellness during these stressful times. From St. Louis Public Radio and PRX, this is We Live Here. African Americans have been the bearers of emotional, psychological, and social trauma for centuries, impacting generation after generation. And even though we are currently in a pandemic which has affected African Americans at a higher rate than any other group, people young and old are putting their lives on the line to demand justice for Black lives. To understand how the uprising is impacting people's mental health and how wellness practitioners are responding at this time, we spoke to Brittini Gray. Brittini, also known as Rebel, runs her own wellness practice called Rebellion that offers healing retreats for Black women and other marginalized people. And she balances her community work while centering her own wellness as a person who is bipolar and has anxiety.
I would say that it's certainly been, in some ways, a challenge because it's so much to take in. I think it's normal for us to have reactions to what's happening in the world and our personal lives, but it also becomes overwhelming. And so I think the pandemic was just a shocker for everyone. What really kind of shifted things for me was the resurgence of uprising. And that was difficult because as it started, I was just coming out of a depression. And so I had to be very mindful of my own mental health and what I was exposing myself to and what energy I was letting in. And so it meant that I had to disconnect in a way that is like not typical for me as a freedom fighter. But now that I like understand how to center my wellness, that was what took precedence for me. And so I haven't been to protests. I limit how much I'm watching the news or reading articles and really just trying to make sure that I'm still providing opportunities for people to heal and to process even in the midst of everything that's happening.
Brittini has been working on two major projects during the pandemic. The first is STL Mutual Aid, a network of organizers coming together to deliver food and supplies, provide financial solidarity, offer emotional support, and connect people to their neighborhoods. And the second is Prepare STL, a collaborative campaign by the Missouri Foundation for Health and the Regional Health Commission to help prepare St. Louisans for the effects of the COVID-19 response, stop the spread, and survive the pandemic physically, emotionally, and economically. We should also note that the Missouri Foundation for Health is a sponsor for We Live Here, but has no control over our content.
I would say that both of those kind of activate my facilitator organizer side, which is cool. Like, I can work with people all day long, but my like personal engagement in terms of where I choose to show up is what I have to be mindful of.
So she chooses to show up as the director of the Black Healers Collective and the organizing director at Empower Institute, a center for community healing and optimal living with roots in families and cultures from the African diaspora.
We're actually on our second round of virtual healing offers. The first round, we had 9 different circles that were running concurrently. This time we have 14, ranging from meditation and yoga to how to parent in a pandemic, to specifically a healing circle for Black men. And so I think that being, like, understanding what's happening in the world, but keeping a inner peace and an inner calm has really helped me get to where we are now.
During the pandemic, in-person events and meetings have all been canceled or postponed, which is why virtual healing options have been so helpful during this time.
I think in terms of the virtual space, particularly when we were in the pandemic, it was really helpful for folks to be able to plug in to spaces that they hadn't had the opportunity to before, right? Like, one of the benefits of being virtual is we don't have the drive time between meetings, and we don't, you know, we just click out of one and click into the next. And that opens up, like, a lot of space and time for folks to engage in ways that they had previously wanted to but couldn't find the time to.
Bertini explains that consistency is key in uncertain times, and that visible, accessible opportunities for people to build community and check in with each other are important.
I think one of the things that oppression does is that it isolates us. It makes us, one, separated and severed from community, but also it makes us feel like we're alone in whatever struggles we are encountering. And so for me, like, the virtual offerings are about having community, having places where you can plug in and know that what you are experiencing, what you are feeling is valid, honor it, and you're not alone.
Liwa Far Bale, a womanist gathering that Bertini co-founded with 2 other women in ministry, is an example of that kind of community.
I think the significance of that space is that as Black women, we don't have, unless we create it, we do not have spaces where we are validated in our fullness and our entirety without stereotypes, expectations, communal burden, etc., weighing on us in whatever space we are in. And so, in some ways, unlike the church, Liwa is a place where Black women can come to just be. They don't have to produce. They don't have to tend to and care for anyone but themselves. And I think that that is a radical space for Black women to be in. Although we are not limited to Black women, that is certainly our basis. But I think for all women of color, there is some truth to that in the way that women are generally the culture bearers of any community. And so for me, I think the mental health aspect of that is around, again, having community, but also just being able to fully be yourself and to explore and to challenge without someone coming back with critique.
Black women have been at the forefront of many movements and continue to fight for change during this renewed uprising for Black lives.
There are so many reasons why I feel like this is, like, the real time for revolution. And a big part of it is that, like, Black women are just becoming very vocal about our mistreatment, even as we are the forefront and primary warriors when it comes to anything in our community. I think the lack of respect that Black women receive intercommunally as well as globally is reflected in the expectations that we continue to produce and protect without receiving anything in return.
As we continue to discuss the strength of Black women in the fight for racial equality, we began talking about the impact that racism and sexism have on Black women's mental health.
Personally, I think of myself in a lot of ways, but one of the primary identities that I hold is that of warrior. And so I support and believe that Black women should continue to be on the front line. My little sister is like, no, we need to stop creating spaces where Black girls are expected to live into this, I fight for everybody, right? So like, we don't all agree, and that's fine. But the common piece is around respect, love, and protection. I think that Black women have always had to bear the brutality of racism in this country right alongside Black men. It has never been an opportunity for us to be exempt from that experience. And we also have a whole other host of oppressive experiences that we carry that Black men do not. Because as women, we also deal with patriarchy and misogyny, but specifically misogynoir when it comes to our own communities. And so the burden that Black women carry is heavy. And so I honor Black women in whatever they decide to do with their lives. If that means that they want to plug in and fight harder, I support that. If that means they want to completely unplug and just focus on themselves, I also support that. I think whatever is going to create the space for us to feel whole and like honest and authentic in our being, then that's what we need to be doing. I think that's what's good for our mental health.
So we asked Brittany, through all of the organizing work and her own personal journey with mental health, what is carrying her through this stressful time?
The dream of freedom, of full expression, of building new ways of being. I am at my core an abolitionist, and I think we actually need to abolish everything. I don't think anything in our current institutional structures works. And so as we are destroying, dismantling, deconstructing, I want to be of service as we imagine, as we dream, as we cultivate.
Up next, we hear from two Black psychologists about the impact of racism on mental health and what creative ways they're helping Black people maintain and promote their mental health and well-being.
Hey everyone, it's Jalian. There's a lot we still don't know about how the pandemic is affecting mental health, let alone how it's affecting the mental health of African Americans, who are having to manage its disproportionate impacts on their loved ones while living in a country where police brutality and racist attacks on Black people have continued and even escalated during this crisis. But Dr. Kira Hudson-Banks, a clinical psychologist and associate professor at St. Louis University, is well practiced in making sense of new and historic data and creating solutions to shift systems and map a path forward. She served as the racial equity consultant for the Ferguson Commission and has continued as the racial equity catalyst for Forward Through Ferguson. She's also part of the Black Healers Collective directed by Brittini, who we met at the top of the show.
So in St. Louis, the Black Healers Collective offers a series of virtual sessions. Some are one-on-one, some are group setting, and they're free. And it's a group of Black healers, so from different modalities. We have folks who are psychologists, nurses, acupuncturists, ministers, massage therapists.
The Black Healers Collective emerged after Michael Brown Jr. was killed in 2014, and they've had to adapt to the pandemic and the renewed uprising for Black lives.
We understand that as we work towards liberation in movement space, that also means having some sustained mental health practices that tap into our resilience. And so we have historically had community healing events where we'll, you know, have a big tent up, people will come, and we'll have a series of different activities people can engage in. And so at first, it was hard for us to envision how we would switch that over to virtual. But what we decided to do is to break out some of the different sessions and just have different Zoom calls. So I've led a circle around parenting in the pandemic, and it was really powerful because it's a pretty isolating experience to be parenting during the pandemic. It's intense and isolating. There have been groups that are around how folks of different genders are experiencing the pandemic, activists. So the way that they've adapted is to take their activities virtual. And then the listening sessions, those are times, 30-minute slots where you can sit and process what's happening, what's going on. I went to this protest and I was anxious because of COVID, but I also felt really important for me to be out there and trying to find my lane, like whatever you need to process.
Virtual mental wellness resources, such as the Black Healers Collective, are important as people's mental health shifts during the pandemic.
We're, of course, having data emerge all the time, and a lot of the focus is on people's diagnosis of COVID, but we're also seeing people talk about their experience of depressive symptoms, anxiety symptoms, because of not only the fear around the virus, but also the shelter at home orders, just being confined in a way that we're not used to being, not having the same access to our routines, to our friends, to our places that we're used to going to, right? Like those routines mean a lot. And so we are seeing people feel more lethargic than they used to be and feeling more anxious. And so those are symptoms that are important to keep an eye on. But I just wanna also make clear that having those symptoms does not equal necessarily having the diagnosis of depression or anxiety.
She explains that the increased likelihood of having family members, friends, and loved ones impacted by COVID-19 adds to the stress experienced by Black Americans at a time when people are unable to grieve in the ways that they're used to.
In the stress literature, we know that those additive stressors can matter, and that in particular, race-related stressors have significant impact on mental health. So extrapolating from, you know, other research, because the data around COVID is still emerging, I would imagine that we would see higher levels of stress and anxiety. At the same time, even if we didn't, I think that we should not conclude that Black people aren't stressed. It might be that we're more astute at being able to navigate multiple stressors at a time.
But as Lauren explained at the top of the show, fighting for Black lives isn't new, and neither is the mental toll that racism takes on Black Americans.
The way people are coping is the way that they were coping when it was Trayvon Martin and Michael Brown and Philando Castile and all of the people, Sandra Bland, right? All of the people who've been taken by police brutality. So some of it is simply remembering that muscle. What do I need to do to stay grounded? And it can be anywhere. People talk about using music, yoga, breathing, prayer, connecting with family and friends. Those are all things that sometimes when things are stressful, we forget to do. But what's interesting about this time is it's not only police brutality, but we also have major incidents of racism, like Amy Cooper weaponizing white supremacy in a way that many of us have experienced, but didn't quite get on video. And on top of all of that, on top of all the names, the Breonna Taylors and the Ahmaud Arbery's, we have COVID, which we are disproportionately impacted by, right?
Grounding practices are important not only for resilience, but also for physical health.
The more stressed we are, the more likely we are to potentially get sick, and the more susceptible we are to low mood. And so when you add that with sleep problems, maybe staying up and being unable to separate from your phone, or staying up and watching videos, and then those images might impact our sleep. So it does vary, right? It depends on the person and how much they're taking in, and what their previous history of maybe difficulty sleeping was. But it's real that the stress that we're under can impact our physical and our mental health, and that those are connected. And so it is important that we take care of our physical and mental health so that we can potentially stave off some difficult times.
And the increased availability of teletherapy can help too.
There are resources for you to access sometimes free or low cost mental health services. A lot of universities have clinics that do a sliding scale fee, and many of those clinics are doing telehealth. Just like you are doing doctor's visits telehealth, you can have therapy telehealth. So this is interestingly a time where, even though it might seem like folks don't have access because it's hard for people to move around, that if you have access to a phone or to a computer or to something that gets you on the internet, right, you actually might be more able to get to a therapy session than if you were having to drop a kid off and find childcare or get from here to there. So it's an interesting time, if you can get over whatever stigma you might have around help seeking, to look for options.
These resources and practices are important for individuals to cultivate wellness, but Dr. Kira reminds us that Black mental health will remain an uphill battle as long as racism persists.
Black people feel deeply, have a wide emotional life, just like anyone. And so it would be unrealistic to think that the inequities we experience don't have the possibility of impacting our mental health. But what we know is that not everyone who's discriminated against is depressed or anxious. We know that. We know that there are many variables that buffer people against the negative effects. So it's not a direct one-to-one, but I do think it's worth people realizing, like, if you can understand the depth of the depths of structural oppression and structural racism, it shouldn't be too hard of a leap to think that those real dire effects would also connect to one's mental health.
It's even more troubling to consider the effects of racism on mental health for children, whose lives are already being disrupted in major ways during the pandemic. The televised killing of George Floyd by a white police officer in Minneapolis and racist attacks across social media have made household conversations on racism unavoidable.
It's been fascinating how many parents are really genuinely anxious and scared, and that it's impacting them. I was on a podcast the other day, and it was a white mother that I was talking to, and she was asking me questions. And I mean, she really was brought to tears and was distraught over figuring out how she's going to raise her daughter and wanting to do it right.
Dr. Kira is the CEO and host of Raising Equity, a podcast and consulting service that helps adults cultivate an equity mindset in themselves and their kids. These are the most common questions that Dr. Kira has been getting from parents and guardians.
Where do I start? And when, how early do I start? It's like, what do I say? Like, where do I begin this conversation? And how early do I need to start talking to them? I say you start talking to them about race as early as they are babies, because they notice race, they see skin tone and skin color as babies. That's what they are noticing. They're learning the world. And so as soon as you put books in their hands or talk to them, right? You can talk about somebody's pretty brown skin. You can show them books that have different grades of hair. You can talk to them about melanin. That will set the foundation for them to understand race outside of the context of racism, so that as they get older, because research shows that they start to pick up the baggage that we have about race and racism at about preschool.
These conversations are easier said than done, and Dr. Kira has had to bear the responsibility of being a parent to two Black sons, even as she continues her racial equity work.
A mentor of mine, Beverly Tatum, who wrote Why Are All the Black Kids Sitting Together in the Cafeteria, reminded me. We did a Facebook Live on my Dr. Kira Banks Facebook page, and I was so excited to talk with her because people had questions about how to talk to their kids about race. And so at the end, I was selfish and I said, so what advice do you have for me? Because we both have two boys. Her boys are grown. Mine are 10 and 13. And so I asked her what advice she had for me. And I also asked her how she remains so hopeful. And what she reminded me was that hope is a discipline. And that really struck me, that hope is a discipline. It's something we have to practice. Anything we want to be good at, we have to practice. So there are days when I wake up and I'm tired and I just think, can we climb this mountain? This just feels insurmountable. And I remind myself of what she told me, that it's a discipline. So, all right, how am I working that muscle today? And so the reminder that I don't have to like be filled with hope to be hopeful, that it's something I can generate, I can cultivate, to me gives me calm and allows me to be compassionate with myself when I maybe don't naturally feel hopeful.
The pandemic is hard on adolescents who are coming of age in a time when they can't learn or socialize in the ways they once could. Dr. Sherita Butler Barnes, a developmental psychologist and associate professor at the Brown School of Social Work at Washington University in St. Louis, explains that it's been especially difficult for Black adolescents who are having to cope with coverage of police brutality and racist attacks on social media, grief from the disproportionate impact of COVID-19 on African Americans, and having parents who are more likely to be essential workers. She's been working with school districts on healthy school climates that promote mental wellness and racially equitable educational outcomes.
Who's present within a curriculum? What are you talking about during history? You know, during social studies, what are they learning about their government? And the sorts of activities that schools do to make sure that it is really a racially and diverse, inclusive environment.
Just as it is for Dr. Kira, this work is personal, as she continues to process the effects of the pandemic and state responses to the current uprising for Black lives with her 9-year-old and 14-year-old daughters.
I'm a Black American. I'm a Black woman. I have family back in Detroit. That's where I originate from. When COVID initially happened, at the very beginning of it, I lost 10 people in 2 weeks. Having conversations with my children about it were very difficult. I have a 9-year-old, and when I was talking to her about COVID, and when I was talking about, you know, talking to her when we saw people protesting, and when we saw the Federal Reserve come in, Federal Guards, when we saw those folks come in, I had to have a conversation with her and explain it, and she was scared to go to sleep at night. She was very afraid. I have a 14-year-old where we're having conversations with her, and she seems to be developmentally cognizant of what's going on. She's more developmentally mature in comparison to a 9-year-old. But she was very distressed, upset about it. But we also told her about her ancestors, about the history, about our own family history, and about our own family members sort of standing up against racial injustice. And so that helped her. And this is a conversation that we have to have every day. So it wasn't just with, you know, the uprisings, but it was also with, you know, Breonna Taylor. It was also with George Floyd, Michael Brown, Atiana Jefferson, Tamir Rice, Trayvon Martin. I can just, you know, the list goes on, right? So this is an everyday process of socialization in a household, and emotions have been from hope to being afraid to being enraged, being angry to hopeful. So this is sort of what's happening in my household.
She explains that household conversations help African American children and children of color develop a healthy racial identity and make sense of traumatic events.
The conversations are difficult. I talk to parents who struggle with Black parents who are struggling with this idea of how am I going to talk to my child about a George Floyd, about a Breonna Taylor, about a Rashad Brooks, because, you know, we thought that we would be so far removed from this, but here it is again, right? And so it's these conversations that we are consistently having, but it's imperative that we do have them.
Her research suggests that for African American children, a healthy racial identity includes feeling positive about being Black and having a sense of self that centers being Black.
One of the things that Black folks have always been, you know, we pride ourselves on is the idea of kinship. So neighbors coming together, family members coming together, but in a very safe way, not during a stay-at-home order, but in terms of helping families out like that. So I think that that's one of the ways that we were able to sort of get through this, and in all honesty, still trying to navigate through this. And I think this is where you see the power of social media, the positivity of that.
In a study that was published in 2017, Dr. Butler Barnes and her colleagues found that African-American adolescent girls who have a healthy racial identity are more likely to persist in their studies, be academically curious, and withstand the effects of an unwelcoming or even hostile school environment.
It has to be in a way that schools are engaging in anti-racist training purposefully and intentionally to be able to support kids. Because if not, you know, there's a lot of detrimental things that can happen, such as low education achievement, but also poor mental health outcomes.
Faith communities can also play an important role in supporting mental health among Black youth.
right now, according to the Pew Research Foundation, and what we know is that African Americans are the most religious group in the U.S. to date. And so what that means is, what is the role church of, you know, being involved in this? And so youth who have a consistent amount of prayer, who attend religious activities, who engage in their church in ways that uplifts the community, kind of around civic engagement, they learn the role and the help of the church. So those are like support systems.
She believes that conversations on race should happen in non-Black households as well.
They need to have a conversation with their children about this, because not having a conversation with them, you are communicating that it's not important. You don't have conversations with them. I think it's important that parents inform their children, white parents in particular, and I guess non-Black parents, period, of your role within society, how either you were, you know, and I always start off with the conversation, either we're beneficiaries of slavery or we are victims of slavery, right? And so talk about your place within the system, your privileges that are associated with you and your family, and the privileges that others don't have. Not talking about it does not mean it's not going to happen, because I don't have that luxury of not talking about it with my child. And so it's important that we all are cognizant and present of what's happening now. And it's not fair to just say, oh, well, you know what? I'm just not going to talk to my child about it because of age or because it's just not impactful to them. And I want to reiterate that not talking about it is talking about it.
And just as Black families might turn to social media for resources on how to develop a healthy racial identity that allows their children to be proud of being Black, non-Black families can also turn to social media to educate themselves with anti-racist trainings and teachings for their children. But another way that families are educating their children on race is by bringing them to protests. In Florissant, a small town in North St. Louis County, we met a young white mom who was starting early by bringing her baby to a protest at the Florissant Police Department.
I want him to, you know, understand equality and the whole movement, so.
How old is your little one, and is this your first one, or?
No, this is my second, and he's 8 months.
Wow.
And you said you came with someone, you were driving?
Her.
A friend, or?
Yeah. Yeah, we just went to the store, and then we like passed you guys, and so we decided to turn around and see what it was about, and then we were like, we're gonna stop and support it, so.
Yeah, when did you first hear about things going on? Because you said you were hearing about it, you're interested.
Yeah, like with the whole George Floyd thing that happened, and I've been wanting to go to some protests. I've just been working a lot. Like, my husband passed away in December, so I'm a single mom, so having a babysitter in that. And so we were here, and I was like, whatever, we got him, we're just going to do it, so.
And has this changed your approach to raising your children?
Well, I've always just, like, been for, like, equality all the way. Like, I never grew up with that. Like, my mom has always taught me, like, everybody's equal, no matter religion, race, anything. So I try to instill that in my kids, too. So another reason why we're out here.
And what changes are you hoping for in the future?
That, you know, the police stop with the systematic racism, and, like, that we can all just be one, you know.
But the uprising doesn't just include tense encounters with the state. Alongside direct action, demands, and civil disobedience are opportunities for joy and celebration. This was the case on Juneteenth when Action St. Louis, a local grassroots racial justice organization, organized a March for Justice in partnership with the National Movement for Black Lives Coalition. The march started at the old courthouse, where enslavers once sold Black people, and Dred and Harriet Scott sued for their freedom. And it went to City Hall, where organizers shared a list of demands that included the call to defund the police, close the workhouse or St. Louis City's medium security institution, and expand Medicaid. As people wheat-pasted these demands to City Hall walls, people began singing and dancing to celebrate Black pride, Black power, and Black joy, against the backdrop of bright yellow balloons and umbrellas.
I absolutely think it's something that can strengthen racial identity, it can strengthen self-worth, it can strengthen self-esteem. I mean, this year, this was like the pivotal year of it. And I just saw so much beauty. I saw so much pride. I saw the intentional spaces that were created to talk about this, materials being created to share with others and families. And just this time of the history, learning about where we've been, the past and the present. And I just think that this particular generation is going to be tooled in a way that I wasn't tooled to sort of address these issues. So it was definitely a beautiful thing to see. And it was also beautiful seeing other folks share in it and even to learn about Juneteenth. We are in spaces where we still have to fight. And again, I think it's linked to the fact of racial socialization, hearing the stories, you know, the oral traditions of our parents, of our grandparents, of our great-great-grandparents, of those who have been in these riots, who have been in these movements. And right now, this is a space where they're saying they are fed up and it's enough. White supremacy is enough. Patriarchy is enough. Let's end racist practices, policies. Let's talk about systemic racism, but also let's hold others accountable for their personal racial racialized experiences as well. I think that youth are tired, and I think they are the next wave of future leaders and future activists. With each generation, as these things happen, these uprisings, we're not going to see kids sitting. And the fact that we're out there, people are risking their lives to be out there because they have to be out there. I'm sure if we didn't have to be out there, we would not do it, right? But these kids are out there because they believe in something greater than what those people are saying about them.
This show is produced by me, Jalian Yang, and my co-producer, Lauren Brown. This show is overseen by Robert Peterson, Director of Radio Programming and Operations at St. Louis Public Radio. From St. Louis Public Radio and PRX, this is We Live Here.
Support for this podcast comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.